This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with a series called Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of 2004.
Hey, Pee-wee, do you know what time it is?
It's fun time! It's fun time!
Pee-wee's Playhouse, all five seasons, that's 45 episodes, has just been released on DVD. It was broadcast as a Saturday morning kid show from 1986 to 91, but its audience included a lot of adults, like me, who loved the humor, the characters, and the design. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, describes the DVD collection as packed with more entertainment and insanity per minute than any release this side of the Looney Tunes collections. We're going to talk with Paul Rubens about creating his alter ego, Pee-wee Herman. Rubens declined to talk about his past legal problems pertaining to charges of indecent exposure in a Florida adult theater and his collection of vintage erotica. Pee-wee's Playhouse had a great cast of characters. Even the inanimate objects were alive. The chair, the window, and the daisies on the windowsill could all talk. A puppet band of beatnik-style hipsters played jazz, sang, and talked in rhymes. The food in the refrigerator was alive. And in each episode, a robot-like boombox named Conky printed out a secret word.
Ready to assist you, Pee-wee.
Morning, Conky.
What's today's secret word?
Today's secret word is
good.
Now, you all know what to do whenever anybody says a secret word, right?
Scream!
That's right.
For the rest of the day, if anybody says a secret word,
scream real loud. Ready? Let's try it. Guys, what are you doing?
Cool cats pounding out the beat.
And we're standing with our feet.
Like they're dancing, man.
I can dig it. Hey, let me try rhyming.
Cool.
I'd talk like you do if I could.
Come on, Pee-wee, you're doing good.
A great big scream is what we heard.
I must have said the secret word.
This rhyming's fun, I agree, but now it's time to play with me.
Hey, Magic Screen, that was really good!
Let's hear the interview I recorded with Paul Rubens. I thought it was pretty good. Well, let's start at the very beginning of the birth of Pee-wee Herman. How did you first create the character? I think this was back in the Groundlings era when you were working with that improv comedy group.
Yeah, it was, I believe, 1977. I was three, and we were doing a night where we were kind of doing an extended scene, what we called an extended scene, and we were trying to do something where it was like a comedy club, like the Comedy Store or the Improv. We were all supposed to be different characters that you might see in a comedy club. So I decided to be the guy at the comedy club that everybody would like immediately know this guy was never going to make it as a comic. And part of it was because I couldn't remember jokes in real life. I couldn't remember the punchline, or I'd get halfway through the joke and I was always the guy who'd be like, oh, wait, no, I forgot to tell you this part, you know. So that's and that character just sort of came out that night. I mean, I borrowed a suit from the director of the Groundlings, Gary Austin. I borrowed his suit, which had been made for him by a guy named Mr. J, if he's out there listening. And somebody else gave me a little tiny bow tie. I had a little one-inch long harmonica that said Pee-wee on it. And I knew a kid whose last name was Herman. And Pee-wee Herman sounded like the kind of name you would never make up. It sounded like, you know, a totally real name, like made by somebody whose parents were, you know, didn't really care about them.
So, well, let's talk about the creation of the Saturday morning version of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Okay.
Let's start with your voice, since you're speaking to us on the radio. Obviously, you didn't use your regular voice for the character of Pee-wee. How did you arrive at that kind of high and laughy voice that you created?
You know, I had been doing, years before the creation of Pee-wee Herman, I worked at a theater that was the State Theater of Florida called the Oslo Theater, which is still in existence, still a fantastic place, which was in my hometown, Sarasota, Florida. and was based at the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art, which Sarasota, as you may or may not know, was the former headquarters of the winter headquarters of the Ringling Brothers Circus. So there's a lot of Ringling influence there. And I had been doing Life with Father in repertory with a bunch of other shows. And my character, I was the second oldest son, not the star son, but the second banana son. And over a three-month period, and I'm not bragging about this, this probably wasn't a good thing, but my character developed into this total cartoon character. And I didn't really even realize it, but, you know, 3 months down the line, somebody said, wow, do you remember what you were originally doing and what you're doing now? And I was like, wow, that's it is really different. So the voice came from that. That is Pee-wee's voice. It was from, you know, good morning, mother, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that became Pee-wee's voice.
So
I love that story.
So from doing from doing theater, you developed the voice for Pee-wee?
Yep. You sound incredulous.
Well, it sounds like it must have been pretty cartoony by the time it was done.
It was. It was pretty cartoony.
How did that happen? Did you not like the play?
You know, I don't know. No, I loved the play. I thought it was a really great play. I think I just wasn't very professional. I was an idiot. I didn't know you weren't supposed to, like, change it completely into a cartoon. It was unwitting. Unwittingly? I did it unwittingly, Jerry.
My guest is Paul Rubens. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse have been released on DVD. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Rubens, who's best known for his character Pee-wee Herman. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse are now out on DVD. Can we talk a little bit about the look of Pee-wee's Playhouse? It was just such a fantastic set of images. You know, bright colors, all kinds of like shapes and... everything was alive in it. You know, like the chair had arms that could embrace the person sitting in it, and the chair talked, and the window talked. How was the look designed, and were you a part of that?
Were you taking some kind of psychedelic drug when you watched that show? No, I'm just kidding, Terry. The look of the show really had a lot to do with an artist named Gary Panter, who designed the original stage version of it and designed much of the was really the overall production designer and created the look of the show, the television version of it. He was somebody who, when I was really creating that character in the early days of Pee-wee Herman, was kind of like the punk scene in Los Angeles, and he was kind of one of the premier like punk artists. And I had seen a lot of his work. He was in a publication called the L.A. Weekly.
And in Raw Magazine that Art Spiegelman edited.
Exactly. And I'd seen a lot of his work, and I loved his work. And I contacted him and asked him if he would do a poster for a show that I hadn't created yet. And he said, well, why don't I do the poster? And well, actually, he said, let me come down and see what it is. So he came down and saw me in the Groundlings show, where I had my little 10-minute Pee-wee thing, and came backstage and said, I'd love to do it, but why don't I do the whole thing? Why don't I design the sets and the puppets and everything? And I said, yeah, great. So he designed that, and then when we got the deal with CBS a few years later to do it as a real television series, he came on board. He was the first person I hired and said, you know, you gotta do this set. So it was, the rest is history, I guess. But, I think it's probably the most amazing aspect of the show, in my opinion, is the design of it. It was just so startlingly incredible, in my opinion.
Now, you said that one of the things you really loved about the character of Pee-wee Herman was that he showed that it was okay to be different. What did you feel was most different about you when you were growing up?
You know, I guess I felt like a total oddball almost every minute of growing up, so it'd be hard to kind of isolate that. But, I think that sort of was the whole point of the show, or at least a big point of the show, was that, like, you know, it would be hard to stand out in the Playhouse, you know? Like, everything stood out in the Playhouse. So you could sort of feel right at home, no matter who you are or what you were thinking or anything.
Tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like, where you grew up, and what your school years were like. Were you uncomfortable in school? Did you do well in school? Were you picked on?
Well, I grew up in an orphanage, and...
Oh, stop.
Oh, no, that was my fantasy character, sorry. I grew up in upstate New York, Oneonta, New York, until we moved in in between third and fourth grade, we moved, which was like a huge relief to me because Mrs. Lake that I had in third grade was really mean to me and scared the hell out of me as far as math goes. Like I still to this day, if I got to add or subtract anything, I almost go into a coma. So we moved. So I had an incredible upbringing in upstate New York, which included the New York State Teachers College is in Oneonta, and there was a laboratory school that my sister and I went to. And we lived in a really small town where there was lots of nature and animals, and we had a little creek with a crab apple tree across the street. I'm going to burst into tears in a second. it was really like a very storybook kind of upbringing. And then we moved to Florida. And moving to Florida was like incredible. I thought we moved to Hawaii. I thought we were in the tropics or something. And my mother took us to go get back to school clothes. And I bought all these beachcomber outfits. So I showed up for the first day of school in fourth grade in Florida with like clam digger pants on and these nautical shirts and like a total freak. And the kids at school were like, what are you supposed to be? And the thing that was funny about it in hindsight is like, normally I'm in that kind of situation. I think the kids would probably, you would probably go like, oh, sorry. You know, I didn't know what it was. But me, I was totally like, don't you get it? You know, I'm a beachcomber. What's wrong with you guys? And instead, like the next day, I like put out another variation of the same outfit, and put it on and got back to school and was like, you know, these kids are going to come around or they're not, whatever. But I'm not changing.
Was this your theatrical impulse expressing itself?
I think it was, yeah, at a very early stage.
So when you moved to Sarasota, which you said was the winter headquarters for Ringling Brothers Circus, did you meet any circus people?
Oh, I met lots of circus people. I mean, for one thing, you could see the circus people coming down the street, you know, like the lady with the bright red hair and the wooden shoes, you know, would be obviously a circus person. I mean, you could just tell that they were very show business people in a very small town, a conservative small town. So you could tell who they were. We rented a little house the first year we moved to Sarasota. And we used to hear these explosions all the time. And we never could figure out what they were. And one day, a couple weeks after we moved, our whole family was walking. We took a walk one night after dinner. And we heard this explosion. And we looked in between these two homes. We saw somebody flying through the air in between these two homes. And it turned out that it was the Zucchini family. And they were the family with the giant silver cannon, and they were shooting each other out of a cannon in the backyard.
That's so
bizarre.
And
in fact, years later, when I made my circus movie, we went back to Sarasota and recreated that cannon.
For Big Top Pee Wee?
Yeah.
Wow.
Did
you want to be in the circus after seeing this?
I did. You know, I actually thought that if... I've been asked, like, what would have happened if you weren't successful as Pee Wee Herman? What would you have done? And I really thought I was headed for a career in the circus.
As
the pinheaded guy. No, the the unfunny guy. The guy who, I don't know, I knew how to walk a tightrope. I could do trapeze.
Could you really walk a tightrope?
Oh, yeah.
How'd you learn that?
I went to circus camp when I was young.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I swear.
And did you ever do the Circus Barker rap?
No, I never did that. I considered briefly covering my body with tattoos, but I didn't do that, which is a good thing now because, you know, everybody has that now,
that's
so
right.
It wouldn't really be, like, you know, it'd be sad if I did that. I did. Like, I started out, I had a balance beam act. My parents showed up to circus camp when we were putting on the show, and I had on, like, a little Speedo bathing suit, and I'd get up on the balance beam with a blindfold on and, like, set these, like, rings on fire and do this insane, completely insane act. Like, look, I pulled the blindfold off and looked at my parents. They were both sitting up in the bleachers with their mouths open, like, what have we created? You know, like, totally. I think that was probably an early tip-off to them that I wasn't gonna be an architect.
So were you inhibited or extroverted as a kid?
One or the other?
Or something in between?
You know, honestly, I think I was probably a little of each. I was sort of skitsy when I was, like, a kid. I would be, like, very introverted and, in, you know, up in my room by myself. And then I would be, like, the life of the party, you know, like gathering all the kids around to, like, we had a little stage in our basement that my dad built me once he realized he was raising a little monster actor. So the kids in the neighborhood would come over and try to figure out, like, what was the teeniest part they could give me so they could use the stage. So we would do, like, these murder mysteries where, like, the opening of the show would be me getting pushed off stage into a vat of acid. And then I would be like, you know, my part would be over. And then all the older kids would, like, do the show. It wasn't until later in life I realized, you know, I'd come in and go, like, you've met my attorney, right? Let's see. You know, talk to them.
What TV shows did you watch as a kid?
You know, I was part of an early study on the effects of television on children when I was going to that school in upstate New York I mentioned. I remember being in first or second grade and having some scientists come into our class to ask us questions about, like, what shows we liked. And all the rest of the kids were like, Mickey Mouse Club and Howdy Doody. And my favorite show was I Love Lucy. And so I got, like, selected out of the whole class. I had to go in, you know, leave the office, leave the classroom and go to an office and listen to a bunch of scientists, like, go, like, well, what was it about the I Love Lucy show that that attracts you? And who do you like better, Lucy or Desi or Ethel or Fred? And, you know, I was, like, in second grade. I didn't know any. I just thought, like, well, I like the show just because I like the show. That's a long way to answer. I didn't even answer your question. I watched, in addition to I Love Lucy, when I was really young, I watched, I loved the Mickey Mouse Club. I loved Captain Kangaroo, and I loved Howdy Doody. I was even on the Howdy Doody show. My mother drove me and my sister to New York, and we were on the Howdy Doody show.
In the Peanut Gallery?
Mm-hmm. Somebody knows the Howdy Doody show. Good. Impressive.
What was it like to be inside rather than watching it on the TV?
Very confusing. I remember my sister was so freaked out. She burst into tears right before the show, and she had to be, like, put in an isolation booth. She didn't make it. She didn't make it on the air. But I did. I was like, oh, after this drive, you got to be kidding. Try to axe me from the show. Forget it. I was right up in there. But the thing that was weird about it was, like, you couldn't see Howdy Doody. You couldn't see anything except, like, all the lights and cameras. And, I mean, it was really weird and kind of semi-disappointing.
Why was it disappointing? Oh, because you couldn't see.
Yeah, just because I didn't realize that there were lights and cameras. And, you know, it's something interesting, like, from that experience, I now kind of, when I meet little kids, you know, out and about, like, for, like, we did the DVD signing the other day here in Manhattan, and 1,000 fans showed up, and I spoke to lots and lots of people, including some kids who would, you know, be just sort of staring at me, and I know enough now to say, like, I don't look like myself, do I, you know, and I look bigger, don't I, and that kind of stuff, because, you know, when you're a kid, like, it didn't occur to me that everything was real life size. You know, I thought Buffalo Bob was, like, you know, the size of somebody who could fit inside the TV.
My guest is Paul Rubens. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse have been released in a DVD box set. Here's another clip from the show.
How do I look, everybody?
You look handsome, Pee-wee.
You look like a world-famous baseball player.
Really? You really think so, Globy?
I bet that's just what I'm going to be.
Ricardo called and told me about the trials that they're going to be having for the Little League team.
Good luck, Pee-wee.
Thanks.
Thanks, Magic Screen.
Of course. And my natural ability, keen eye,
strong throwing arm and running speed.
I doubt if I'll be needing good luck. Wish me luck.
Good luck, Pee-wee.
Play ball!
We'll talk more with Paul Rubens after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Rubens, and he created Pee-wee Herman and played Pee-wee Herman, and now all of the Pee-wee's Playhouse episodes that aired on television are collected on DVD for the first time. You were on The Gong Show before the creation of Pee-wee Herman, and it was a kind of vaudeville type of act. I used to watch The Gong Show, but I don't remember your act. Can you tell us something about the act? And about where it got you? Did you get anything by virtue of having been on The Gong Show?
I did a whole bunch of different acts on The Gong Show, and I think of those times very fondly. I was a big fan of The Gong Show. A woman named Charlotte McGinnis, I went to Boston University for a year before I went to California Institute of the Arts, and I was in the acting school at BU. And when I left after a year, but I kept in touch with a core group of people, and someone who came in the year after I left was this girl who I then met 3 or 4 years later when all the people graduated from BU and they all came out to California. And she had just been on The Gong Show, and I met her, and the first thing she said to me was like, "Do you have any interest in being on The Gong Show? I'm looking for a partner to do something on The Gong Show." And so that was kind of me going, okay, I'll try comedy. I mean, I had done comedy, but I hadn't really been focusing on it. I was much more of a serious actor in the James Dean kind of school. And
that's funny. I mean, because your image is so not that right now.
Well, I had a different image and a different image of myself at that time. Mm-hmm. And so she had said, you know, you can join the union after you've been on The Gong Show more than one time. The second time you join the union, which is what she was trying to do, and you get paid. Once you join the union, you get paid for the performance. So I was on The Gong Show about 15 times, and she and I did, we had an act called The Hilarious Betty and Eddie, and we did that on The Gong Show. We won $500, and then they asked us to come back and do it on the nighttime version, which meant I was automatically going to join the union and get paid more money, or get paid, and we won again on the nighttime show. And Artie Johnson said, was one of the judges from Laugh-In, and he said, "What are their names? What are their names again?" And Chuck Barris said, "Betty and Eddie." And he said, "Well, Betty and Eddie, we're going to hear from them in the future." And I literally ran out of the studio and called my parents. I was so excited about it. You know, Artie Johnson recognized us. And being part of this duo act and coming up with material for The Gong Show then led me into The Groundlings, which was an improvisational group which had a real bent towards writing and character creation. And it was pretty early in my career where I realized, like, no one's going to do this for me, you know, like that I needed to write, that I needed to create my own vehicle and create material. And, you know, anyone who's thinking about this kind of career, I would encourage that, really, because you can wait a long, 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 long time for that, you know, fictional or for that person who's going to come and discover you and go, "What's your name? Oh, my God, you know, you're going to be a big star." It just very, very rarely happens like that. So I think, you know, if you're waiting around, you know, you might spend some of that time coming up with some ideas and putting them on a piece of paper.
Paul Rubens, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I had a lot of fun.
Our interview with Paul Rubens was recorded last month. All the episodes of Pee-wee's Playhouse have been released in a new DVD box set. Our end-of-the-year retrospective, Last Laughs, continues tomorrow.